Okay, let's unpack this. For 1.4 billion Catholics worldwide, and honestly for a lot of other people too, a really rare and globally significant event is happening right now, a papal conclave. The wheels are turning to pick a new leader.
Absolutely. Pope Francis, passing away on April 21st, 2025, kicked off this, well, extraordinary and historically packed process. And you're right, it's not just an internal church thing. It really does have global implications.
Exactly. So in this deep dive, we're really getting into the weeds of the upcoming 2025 papal conclave. Our aim here is to pull out the key factors that are going to shape this election and explore where the church might be headed. We're leaning on some detailed analysis and historical context to help us figure it out.
And for you listening, the goal is to give you a clear picture, some real insight into this pretty complex process, but without making your head spin. We want to shed light on the main dynamics and what they could mean down the road.
Yeah, make it understandable. And to do that, we've got this really fascinating and thorough resource, but it's an analysis and prediction report looking specifically at this 2025 conclave. So let's dive in. First things first, who actually gets to choose the next pope?
Right. That falls to the College of Cardinals, specifically the ones who were under 80 years old the moment the papacy became vacant, the sede vacante, as it's called, when the Holy See is empty. And for this conclave, it's a historically large group. 135 cardinals are technically eligible.
Wow. 135 is a lot. But are they all actually going to be there casting votes?
Good question. The current thinking is probably 134 will participate. Cardinal Cañizares Leveret from Spain, he's indicated he can't attend because of health reasons. And then there's the slightly ambiguous situation with Cardinal Betu. He renounced his rights as a cardinal before, and while he is under 80, he's currently listed as a non-elector, so his participation seems unlikely.
Okay, so 134 voters, give or take. What's the magic number then? How many votes does someone need to win? Is it just over half?
No, it's higher than that. It requires a two-thirds supermajority. So with 134 expected voters, a candidate needs to get at least 90 votes. 90.
90 votes.
Yeah, and that high bar, it really forces people to find common ground. It makes it very, very difficult for someone really polarizing to get elected. It pushes towards a consensus candidate, usually.
Makes sense. Now, you hear about different types or orders of cardinals. Can you just quickly remind us what those are?
Sure. The college has three orders: cardinal bishops, cardinal priests, and cardinal deacons. For this election, we're looking at 5 cardinal bishops, 110 cardinal priests, and 20 cardinal deacons. Seniority matters for some ceremonial things, like Cardinal Parolin is the senior cardinal bishop elector, Cardinal Puljich, the senior cardinal priest, and Cardinal Mamberti, the senior cardinal deacon. And crucially, during this in-between time, the sede vacante, the day-to-day running of the Holy See, falls to the Camerlingo. That's Cardinal Kevin Farrell right now. He manages things and gets the conclave ready.
Got it. And the age spread in this group must be pretty significant.
Oh, absolutely. It goes from Cardinal Osorio Sierra of Spain, he's 79, all the way down to Cardinal Bichak, who's a Ukrainian Greek Catholic bishop in Australia. He's only 45.
45? Wow.
Yeah. And it's interesting, 17 of the electors are actually Gen X, born between 65 and 80.
So a bigger group of voters than the last couple of times. What does that actually mean for the election itself? What are the implications?
Well, compared to 2005 and 2013, when there were 115 electors each time, this larger group makes getting that 90-vote supermajority potentially trickier. You need a wider agreement. But on the flip side, the number needed to block a candidate just over a third is now 45 votes.
45 to block.
Right, which is slightly easier to assemble than the 39 needed before. So what does that suggest? Maybe more ballots, potentially a longer deliberation, unless, of course, a really strong consensus forms quickly in those pre-conclave talks.
Okay, bigger group needs broader consensus.
Yep.
Now, one thing Pope Francis was known for was really emphasizing the global nature of the church. How did that focus change who these cardinal electors actually are?
That's a huge point. Pope Francis definitely made a conscious effort to internationalize the College of Cardinals, and you absolutely see that in the makeup of the 2025 electors. It's a major geographical realignment.
Can you break that down for us? Where are the shifts?
Certainly. Europe's share has dropped quite a bit. It was 51% of electors back in 2013. Now it's down to 40% for 2025. That's 53 cardinals.
40%. A historic low, you said.
A historic low, yeah. Italy is still the biggest single national group with 17, then the U.S. with 10.
Okay, so Europe's down. Where did the representation increase?
Primarily in what's often called the Global South. Asia Pacific jumped from 10% in 2013 to 18%. Now that's 23 electors. Sub-Saharan Africa went from 8% up to 12%, so 18 electors there.
Significant jumps.
Very significant. Latin America and the Caribbean saw a slight rise to 18%, that's 24 electors. North America, and this analysis includes the US, Canada, and Mexico, actually dipped slightly to 10%, 13 electors, and Oceania stayed about the same at 3% with 4 electors. This big drop in Europe's share, it really marks a shift away from that historical Western dominance in choosing the Pope. Creates opportunities, but also challenges for building consensus.
It definitely seems like a rebalancing. Does it also mean more countries have a cardinal voting now?
Absolutely. The number of countries represented has gone up from 48 in 2013 to 71 in 2025. Pope Francis appointed the first ever cardinals from places like Haiti, Laos, Myanmar, Rwanda, Timor-Leste.
So the leadership pool is starting to look more like the global church itself. Is it perfectly balanced now, though, proportionally?
Not quite. Even with these big shifts, there's still, let's say, an imbalance compared to where Catholics actually live. Europe, even though its share is down, still has a larger slice of the electors than its share of the global Catholic population. And Latin America, which has a huge percentage of the world's Catholics, is still underrepresented in the college.
Interesting. So with this different map, does it actually make it more likely we'll see a non-European pope this time?
Well, statistically, politically, yes. It's more plausible now than really any time in modern history. Candidates from Asia, Africa, Latin America, they now have much larger home teams, so to speak, within the college.
Yeah.
But, and this is a big but.
There's always a but.
Right. This diversity also creates a challenge. A lot of these cardinals, especially maybe from smaller or more distant dioceses, might not know their colleagues from other continents all that well, or they might not be deeply familiar with how the Vatican works day to day.
So it's harder to build trust and agreement if you don't really know the other guys.
Exactly. That lack of sort of deep pre-existing connection could make it harder to form solid voting blocks. It complicates getting to that two-thirds agreement. And while, yes, a huge chunk were appointed by Francis, you absolutely cannot view them as one single block.
Right. They're not clones.
Not at all. They come from incredibly different places, different pastoral situations. They might have very different theological leanings on some things. So that unfamiliarity could mean a longer initial voting phase while everyone's kind of feeling each other out.
But even with all that, Europe is still the biggest single group, right? They still have clout.
Oh, definitely. The European bloc, with 53 electors, is still the largest regional group. They don't have the numbers to just elect one of their own anymore, but they have significant leverage. They can form a strong base for a European candidate, or they could be kingmakers, you know, throw their weight behind a compromise candidate from elsewhere whose views align with theirs. So yeah, the center of gravity has shifted, but Europe is still a major player.
Okay, understood. So we've got who they are, where they're from. What about the influence of the popes who actually made them cardinals? How does that imprint of pontificates play into this?
That's absolutely critical. The overwhelming majority, I mean, a huge majority of the cardinals voting in 2025, 108 out of the 135, that's 80% were appointed by Pope Francis.
80%. Wow. That's dominant. What about Benedict VI and John Paul II appointees?
Much smaller numbers. Only 22 electors, so 16%, were appointed by Benedict VI. And just 5 electors, a mere 4%, were made cardinals by Pope St. John Paul II. This generational difference in who appointed them really sets the stage. It means conclave experience itself might be concentrated in that minority.
So for most of these guys, this is their first rodeo. Their first conclave.
Exactly. Only those 27 appointed by Benedict and John Paul II. I've actually been through this before, specifically the 2013 conclave that elected Francis. And of that group, only 5 were also in the 2005 conclave that elected Benedict. So yeah, a staggering 80% of the electors are first timers.
With 80% being Francis appointees, you'd think that almost guarantees a successor who will continue his general direction, wouldn't you?
Logically, you might think that, but it's really important to remember the diversity within that 80%. Geographically, experientially, Francis often picked bishops from the peripheries, people with strong pastoral backgrounds, not necessarily because they were ideological copies of him.
Right.
I mean, look at the African cardinals he appointed. Many hold quite conservative views on certain moral issues, as we saw with the reaction to fiducia supplicans. So while 80% is a huge potential base for continuity, it's absolutely not a guaranteed unified voting bloc. Plus, their lack of shared history, maybe in the Curia or in past conclaves, adds another layer of unpredictability.
That's a really important clarification. Diversity even within that big group. What about the minority, though? The Benedict and John Paul II guys, do they still have much influence?
I'd say definitely yes. Those 27 electors, while they're a minority, bring something crucial experience. They were in the room for the last one or two elections. They're the living link to the pre-Francis era. They could easily form the core of a bloc looking for maybe a correction or consolidation. They might attract some Francis appointees who have reservations about certain things or just prefer a more traditional style. And their experience could give them outsized influence in those informal pre-conclave chats, the pratiche, guiding the newcomers. They don't have the numbers to elect someone on their own, but they certainly have enough to block someone or to be key players in building a coalition around a compromise figure.
Okay, so geography, appointing Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at what they actually do. What kinds of jobs do these cardinal electors hold?
They come from various corners of the church structure. Roughly 29 of them, about 21%, work in the Roman Curia, the Vatican's central administration, diplomacy, that sort of thing. The biggest group, around 79 electors, or 59%, are diocesan bishops leading local churches around the globe. And then a significant chunk, 33 electors, about 24%, are members of religious orders, Jesuits, Salesians, Franciscans, and so on.
So even though Francis put a lot of focus on diocesan bishops, the Curia guys still have a pretty strong showing.
They do. That sizable group of curial cardinals means that prospective governance, administration, central church diplomacy is definitely well represented. These cardinals usually know the Vatican machinery inside out. They know each other well. Their experience might be seen as extra valuable after a pontificate that brought big reforms to the Curia itself. But yeah, the sheer number of diocesan pastors reflects Francis's preference for leaders grounded in local reality.
And that difference in background must lead to different ideas about what kind of pope is needed now.
Exactly. You could see a potential tension there. Are they looking for someone with proven administrative chops to run the Vatican effectively? Or do they want someone known more for pastoral energy, for evangelization? Maybe some candidates bridge that gap, having done both. Though, interestingly, some recent chatter suggests there might be a growing feeling among some cardinals favoring someone with solid curial experience, maybe for stability.
That's interesting. Okay, roles, backgrounds. What about underlying theological leanings? Can we even talk about potential voting blocks based on that?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's especially tricky this time because of that diversity and, frankly, the lack of deep familiarity among many of them. The old labels, conservative versus liberal, might not fit as neatly or be as predictive as they maybe were in the past.
So is there a better way to think about the different viewpoints then?
I think a key dividing line, maybe the key dividing line, will be Pope Francis's legacy, basically. Does the church now need primarily continuity with his reformist path? You know, synodality, inclusion, pastoral flexibility, maybe decentralization? Or does it need a period of, let's say, correction or consolidation, focusing more on doctrinal clarity, liturgical unity, strengthening traditional structures?
And are there key candidates, Papa Bili, who seem to line up with those different directions?
Yeah, analysts point to a potential conservative-leaning group, maybe drawing from Africa, Eastern Europe, parts of the U.S. cardinals, who perhaps feel Francis's pontificate created some confusion or division. Cardinal Peter Erdo from Hungary often comes up as a potential leader for that group.
Okay.
On the other side, you have a progressive or continuity group supporting Francis's vision, social justice, the peripheries, synodality. Cardinals Tagle from the Philippines and Zuppi from Italy are often seen as the standard bearers for that view.
But it's probably not just those big labels, right? Specific hot button issues must play a role too.
Oh, absolutely. Beyond the broad strokes, specific issues might be even more decisive in how cardinals align. The future of synodality, definitely. Reactions to liturgical stuff like Praedicianus Custodes, the whole debate and fallout from fiducia supplicans, the role of women, Vatican reform. These could all be rallying points or, you know, deal breakers.
Right.
Look at the unified African resistance to fiducia supplicans led by Cardinal Ambongo. That shows how regional and issue-based groups can form, sometimes cutting right across that 80% Francis appointee majority. Geographical groups exist, sure, but how theologically united they are, especially among the diverse global South appointees, that's less certain.
So it sounds like voting could be more fluid, less predictable this time around compared to past conclaves with more established blocs.
I think that's exactly right. Fluid, less predictable. Alliances might shift based on what comes out in the pre-conclave talks, how candidates present themselves, what the electors start to feel is the most urgent need of the church right now. And in that context where someone stands on a very recent, very concrete controversy, like fiducia supplicans might tell you more about their potential alliances than just slapping a conservative or liberal label on them. And synodality itself, that seems like a major fault line. Different visions for where that goes will heavily influence who they get back.
Okay, this gives us a much clearer picture of the electors and the currents swirling around them. Now, the question everyone wants answered, who are the Papabili? Who's being talked about as the next pope?
Right, the Papabili. But first, the asylum disclaimer, predicting this is, well, famously difficult. History is littered with surprises. You know the Italian saying.
He who enters a conclave as pope leaves it as a cardinal.
Yeah.
Heard that one.
Exactly. So, no guarantees whatsoever. But based on the analysis we have, media buzz, informed guesses about influence, a group of names does keep coming up as plausible contenders.
Okay, laying out the caveats, who's on the list? Let's start with Europe.
From Europe, the names you hear most consistently are Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the current Secretary of State, Cardinal Peter Erdő from Hungary, Cardinal Matteo Zuppi from Italy, and Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem.
Okay, four prominent Europeans. What about other parts of the world? Africa? Asia, the Americas.
From Africa, Cardinal Fridolin and Bongo Basungu of the DRC and Cardinal Peter Turkson from Ghana are frequently mentioned. From Asia, the standout name is definitely Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle from the Philippines. And representing North America, Cardinal Robert Prevost, an American who heads the Dicastery for Bishops, is one to watch. Cardinal Lacroix from Canada is sometimes mentioned, but there's that shadow of a past abuse allegation, even though it was dismissed.
Pretty diverse group already. Any other names bubbling under the surface? Potential dark horses.
Yes, definitely. There are several others who could emerge, especially if the front runners stall. People like Cardinal Claudio Gugerotti, who leads the Dicastery for Eastern Churches. Cardinal Jose Tolentino de Mendonça from Portugal. Cardinal Stephen Chow Sayan from Hong Kong. Cardinal Jean-Marc Aveline from France. Cardinal Anders Arborelius from Sweden. And Cardinal Mario Gretsch, who's basically running the synod process.
Let's dig into a few of the leading names a bit more. Cardinal Parolin, Secretary of State, that's a huge job. Puts him right at the center, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Cardinal Parolin, he's 70. As Secretary of State since 2013, he's the top dog in the Curia, the highest ranking elector. He's a career diplomat, tons of experience in international affairs, generally seen as, you know, moderate, centrist, values diplomacy, institutional stability.
That's right.
Huge understanding of Vatican administration, global diplomacy. He knows basically all the other electors personally, seen as a safe pair of hands.
Downsides. Potential weaknesses.
Well, maybe less direct diocesan pastoral experience. And he's inevitably associated with some controversial Vatican things, the China deal, the London financial stuff.
Who's likely to back him? Who might oppose him?
Probably strong support from moderates who want competence, diplomatic skill, might face opposition from those wanting a more explicitly pastoral figure or those critical of recent Vatican diplomacy or finances. But yeah, consistently seen as a leading front runner.
Okay. Cardinal Erdő. You mentioned him as maybe representing a more conservative direction.
That's right. Cardinal Erdő, he's 72, Archbishop in Hungary. Definitely seen as a key figure for the more conservative wing. He's a highly respected canon lawyer and academic. If electors are looking for a course correction after Francis, maybe emphasizing doctrine, tradition, Erdő is a leading name here.
What are his main strengths?
His intellectual weight, canonical expertise, he's well regarded, especially by many Europeans, offers a clear theological alternative.
And potential liabilities.
Electing him could be read by some as, well, a rejection of Francis's legacy. His perceived closeness to the Hungarian government might worry some electors. And being European might be a disadvantage now with the church's show self. Still, a major contender, seen as the main alternative to the continuity guys.
Okay, shifting continents. Cardinal Tagle from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Very well-known name globally.
Very. Cardinal Tagle, he's 67. Heads up a section of the Dicastery for Evangelization now. Widely seen as closely aligned with Francis's progressive pastoral approach, sometimes called the Asian Francis.
High praise, or maybe a burden, depending on who you ask.
Exactly. He's got huge charisma, a global profile, known for his theological smarts. Strengths are definitely his pastoral reputation, representing the vibrant Asian church and that clear alignment with Francis's vision.
Potential weaknesses.
Maybe some questions about his top-level administrative experience. And being so closely tied to Francis could alienate more conservative electors. But still, a leading contender, probably the most prominent non-European candidate out there.
Back to Italy. Cardinal Zuppi. You put him in that continuity camp, too.
Yes. Cardinal Zuppi, 69, Archbishop of Bologna, heads the Italian Bishops' Conference. Seen as a major progressive voice in Italy, maybe the one most seen as a potential Pope Francis II. Deep ties to the Sant'Egidio community, known for working with the poor, peace efforts, Lots of grassroots pastoral experience.
Strengths seem clear there.
Highly regarded pastoral skills, yeah. His recent diplomatic work, like the Ukraine peace mission, leading the influential Italian bishops. Downsides, again, that strong identification with Francis and Sant'Egidio could be a negative for conservatives. Maybe too close to Francis for those wanting a real change, but definitely a primary continuity candidate alongside Tegel.
And one more profile look. Cardinal Pizzaballa, often mentioned as a possible compromise figure.
That's a very common assessment. Cardinal Pizzaballa, he's 60, Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem. He's a Franciscan, spent decades in the Holy Land navigating that incredibly complex situation. Seen generally as moderate, pragmatic, big focus on interreligious dialogue, peace.
What makes him a potential compromise?
He's widely respected for his leadership there. He apparently did a good job sorting out finances in the patriarchate. And he's not strongly identified with either the progressive or conservative poles on some of the big debates. That could appeal across the board if others get stuck.
Anything counting against him?
He's relatively young, 60. A very long pontificate might worry some. And
yeah.
Maybe not having super strong public positions on some divisive issues could be seen as a weakness by those wanting clearer direction. But yeah, definitely a compelling figure, often flagged as a strong potential compromise or dark horse.
These profiles really do highlight that central tension we talked about.
Yeah.
It feels like it boils down to continuity, correction, or maybe finding some middle ground, a compromise.
Exactly. The candidates we just looked at really illustrate that. Tegel and Zuppi for continuity, Eridu for correction, and then Perelin, Pizzaballa, Prevost, and Bongo Gujarati. They could represent a more moderate path or be seen as potential compromise figures.
And given everything we've discussed about the voters, the diversity, the lack of familiarity in the rules, especially that two-thirds majority, does compromise seem more likely than the other options?
I think the structure really points in that direction. The diversity, the fact many don't know each other well, no single dominant frontrunner, that tough two-thirds requirement, it all increases the odds that a compromise will be needed. If the first few rounds show a deadlock between the main polls, electors will naturally start looking for someone who can unite a broad coalition.
So who does that favor?
It tends to favor candidates seen as competent, experienced, maybe less ideologically sharp-edged, someone with proven bridge-building skills or strong administrative ability. History shows conclaves often pivot to compromise figures when the initial favorites hit a wall of opposition.
Let's look at that history. What can the last two conclaves, 2005 and 2013, tell us about what might happen in 2025?
Yeah, looking back at 2005 and 2013 gives us really valuable clues about voting patterns, the importance of those pre-conclave talks, and how the previous pope's legacy hangs over everything.
So starting with the voting itself, what happened in 2005 and 2013? How did the votes line up?
Well, 2005, which elected Benedict XVI, showed how powerful early momentum can be. Reports say Cardinal Ratzinger started with a strong chunk of votes and just steadily climbed over the next few ballots, reached two-thirds on the fourth ballot. Cardinal Bergoglio, ironically, was the main alternative then, but couldn't stop Ratzinger.
And Pope Francis himself confirmed some of that later, didn't he?
He did. He said Ratzinger was his pick in 05, and that his own name, Bergoglio, was used strategically by some against Ratzinger, trying to force a compromise, a move Bergoglio himself apparently resisted. Fascinating insight.
Very. In 2013, when Francis was elected, different story.
Somewhat different, yeah. The first ballot in 2013 was much more spread out. No clear front runner right away. Cardinal Scola, Cardinal Bergoglio, Cardinal Ouellet all got significant votes initially. But then the momentum shifted and shifted decisively towards Bergoglio. He was elected on the fifth ballot after just 2 days. And it's worth remembering, while Bergoglio was known, partly from 05, he wasn't really seen as a top-tier frontrunner right before the 2013 conclave started. His election was definitely a surprise to many observers.
So being the favorite going in is definitely no guarantee. Adds to the suspense, I guess.
Exactly. Modern conclaves have a mixed record for frontrunners. Ratzinger made it. John Paul II and Francis were surprises, to different degrees. It's rare, like with Paul VI, for the clear favorite to actually win. Early momentum can be key, but if it stalls, things can change fast. So 2025 could go either way. Strong candidate gets momentum like 2005, or it starts fragmented and leads to a compromise like 2013. Given the current field, the lack of experience, something closer to 2013, maybe a surprise or compromise, feels quite possible.
Okay, beyond the voting itself, what about all the stuff that happens before they're locked in the Sistine Chapel, those general congregations?
Oh, that period between the Pope's death and the start of the conclave is absolutely crucial. Dominated by those formal general congregations and the informal chats, the potiche. Officially, the congregations organize the funeral, the conclave logistics, but their real importance is as a forum for discussion, for sharing views.
What kinds of things do they actually talk about in those meetings?
Well, leading up to 2013, they used that time to discuss the state of the church, the big challenges, Benedict's legacy, what qualities they wanted in the next pope. It's vital for cardinals, especially those from far away or the first timers, to get to know each other, hear different perspectives, start sizing up potential candidates. And for this 2025 conclave, the general congregation started right away. By April 25th, apparently almost 70 cardinals had already formally spoken about the church and the world. That's a lot of engagement, suggests serious discussion is happening.
And those informal chats, the pratiche, you said they're really influential too.
Hugely influential. These are the unofficial, private conversations happening outside the formal meetings. They're where the really frank talk happens, where candidacies get tested, where individual cardinals start forming their ideas and maybe linking up with others. Given how many first-timers there are this year, and how diverse the group is, what people learn, the impressions they form, the alliances they might sketch out during both the formal congregations and these private pratiche, that's likely going to have an enormous impact on the voting. This pre-conclave period is arguably more critical than ever for figuring out who's viable and building potential consensus.
And finally, the shadow of the previous pope,
mm-hmm.
obviously Pope Francis in this case. How much will his 10 years influence the cardinal's choice?
Every conclave happens in the shadow of the one before it. The appointments, as we said, the teachings, the policies, the style, it all becomes the context. There's that old fat pope, thin pope idea suggesting swings back and forth.
Right. Some people predict a more conservative pope now based on that.
Right. Exactly. Ratzinger's election in 05 was seen as continuity with John Paul II. Bergoglio's in 13 was partly seen as a reaction to governance issues under Benedict, a desire for reform. So 2025 is absolutely happening in the context of Francis's decade, his big initiatives like synodality, pastoral mercy, but also the debates and tensions they start up.
So the big question is, continue, correct, consolidate.
Or transcend. Yeah, how should the next guy relate to that inheritance? The Francis effect is baked into the big issues now. The Synod on Synodality, Amoris Laetitia, Fiducius Supplicans, Traditionis Custodes on the Liturgy, Curia Reform in Praedicat Evangelium. And reactions to all that were varied, even among Francis's own appointees. So the dynamic might be less about just continue versus reject, and more about finding someone who can navigate and maybe refine Francis's legacy, foster unity, tackle the challenges ahead, which might maybe lead some to want a transitional figure, perhaps an older, respected cardinal for a shorter, say, 10-year papacy to consolidate things.
Okay, let's get into the actual rulebook. What's Universi Dominici Gregis, and how does it control the whole conclave process?
Right. Universi Dominici Gregis, or UDG for short, that's the main law governing papal elections. John Paul II issued it in 96. Benedict XVI tweaked it a bit later. It lays out everything. Powers during the seat of vacante, preparing the conclave, who can vote, how the voting works, and importantly, the secrecy rules.
And a key part of that is the two-thirds majority rule. Why is that specific number so important?
UDG is crystal clear. The only way to elect a pope is by secret written ballot, per scrutinium. To win, you need at least two-thirds of the votes from the electors present. For 2025, with 134 expected, that's 90 votes. And remember, Benedict VI changed it back in 2007, so it's always two-thirds, for every single ballot.
You got rid of that possibility of switching to a simple majority after a long deadlock.
Exactly. He reversed that. Now, there is a provision for a runoff between the top two after many ballots, but even then, the winner needs two-thirds of the runoff votes, and the two candidates themselves can't vote in that runoff.
So that perpetual two-thirds rule has big consequences.
Huge. It means you have to build a broad coalition. It gives real power to a blocking minority, just over a third, 45 votes. This time they can stop anyone they strongly oppose. It really ups the pressure to find a compromise candidate eventually.
Secrecy seems almost like the defining feature of a conclave from the outside. Why is it so incredibly strict?
UDG mandates extreme secrecy for everyone involved, cardinals, staff, everyone. Break it, and it's automatic excommunication. The whole area, the Sistine Chapel, the Domus Sancte Marthe, where they live, it's sealed off. No communication with the outside, electronic surveillance countermeasures.
Why go to such lengths?
The main goals are protect the elector's freedom from any outside pressure or influence, allow for really frank internal discussions, and encourage a focus on spiritual discernment. Now, obviously, maintaining total secrecy in the age of smartphones is a challenge, and people do criticize the lack of transparency.
Right.
But that enforced isolation, combined with the solemn rituals, it creates this intense psychological bubble. It could foster unity, but it could also heighten tensions, the sheer weight of the decision. Maybe it even speeds up the search for consensus just to resolve that pressure.
Can you walk us through the steps once they actually start the conclave, the rituals, the voting?
Sure. The conclave is set to start May 7th. It begins formally with the mass pro eligendo papa for the election of the Pope in St. Peter's Basilica. Then the cardinals process solemnly into the Sistine Chapel, chanting prayers like the Litany of Saints and Veni Creator Spiritus, asking the Holy Spirit for guidance. Inside, each elector takes an oath, promising to follow the rules and keep secrecy.
And then they lock the doors.
Pretty much. The Master of Papal Liturgical Celebrations declares extra omnes, everyone out, and anyone not part of the conclave leaves. The doors are sealed, then the voting starts. Each elector gets a ballot, writes, Eligo in summum pontificem, I elect as supreme pontiff, and the name of their choice. They fold it, walk to the altar, take another oath, put it in the urn. Three scrutineers, chosen by lot, count the votes. Usually one vote the first afternoon, then two in the morning, and two in the afternoon on following days.
And the famous smoke signals.
After each count, the ballots are burned. If no one gets two-thirds, they add a chemical to make black smoke, fumata nera, no popia. If someone does reach two-thirds, they burn the ballots clean, making white smoke, fumata bianca. That's the signal.
Habemus papam.
Exactly. Once someone hits 90 votes, the dean asks them two questions. Do you accept? Accepto. And by what name shall you be called? Once he says yes and picks a name, he is the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. Then the senior cardinal deacon goes out onto the balcony of St. Peter's, announces Habemus Papam, we have a Pope, gives the new Pope's birth name and chosen papal name, and finally the new Pope comes out and gives his first blessing, Urbi et Orbi, to the city and to the world.
So the stage is set, the electors are nearly all there, the rules are clear. Let's talk about the big issues weighing on the church right now. These must be huge factors in who the cardinals choose.
Oh, absolutely. There are several massive concerns they'll be grappling with. One of the biggest, maybe the overarching one, is the path of synodality. This whole walking together idea was central to Francis's papacy, culminating in that multi-year synod on synodality.
Which just finished its assembly phase last year, right?
Right. And the final report had proposals on seminary training, lay involvement, women's roles, maybe changing canon law. How the next pope handles the future direction and implementation of all that will be a huge test, a real sign of alignment or not with Francis's vision. Francis approved a three-year implementation phase leading to a global assembly in 2028.
Weren't some tricky issues deferred, though?
Yes, the really contentious stuff, women deacons, LGBTQ+ pastoral care got punted to study groups. They're supposed to report back by June 2025, right after the conclave. So synodality isn't just one issue. It wraps up bigger debates about authority, decentralization, consultation, how to tackle sensitive questions. Different candidates will have different takes. Zuppi, Gretsch, Hollerich probably pushing forward, others maybe more cautious. What potential popes intend for that implementation phase will definitely be a hot topic in the pre-conclave chats.
Note other big things will be on their minds.
Liturgy is always sensitive, often a proxy for bigger theological fights. Francis restricting the traditional Latin Mass with Traditionis Custodes definitely stirred things up. Where a candidate stands on liturgy, especially Traditionis Custodes, signals a lot about their broader stance, the relation to Francis's legacy and Benedict's.
Are there candidates known for being more open on that front?
Some reports mention Zuppi, Herbarelius, Erder as having shown some openness to those attached to the older liturgy. Others might be firmer on the restrictions. And the synod itself called for a study group on synodality and liturgy, so that's an area potentially up for more discussion. Cardinals who care deeply about liturgy will be weighing this heavily.
You've hit some sensitive nerves there.
Yeah.
What about that ongoing tension between sort of doctrinal rules and real-world pastoral application?
Yeah, that's central. Francis heavily emphasized pastoral mercy, welcoming people on the margins. That got different reactions. Amoris Laetitia and the whole debate about communion for divorced and remarried Catholics, you saw figures like Erder raise concerns, while others like Zuppi, Tegel, Tolentino were more open.
And more recently, fiducia supplicans.
Huge controversy. That declaration allowing blessings for same-sex couples under specific conditions, it gave intense pushback, especially the unified resistance from African bishops led by Cardinal Ambongo. You can bet a candidate's stance, public and private, on fiducia supplicans will be scrutinized intensely. It could absolutely make or break support, especially with African and more conservative cardinals.
What about the role of women? The synod touched on that, but deferred the deacon question.
Right. The synod pushed for maximizing women's leadership within current church law, but punted on women deacons. That suggests maybe hesitation among many cardinals for really radical changes right now. So candidates focusing on practical ways to increase female leadership under existing rules might actually have broader appeal.
And beyond theology and pastoral care, what other major challenges will they be considering?
Several key things. Ongoing Vatican reform, Francis's Curia overhaul with Praedicate Evangelium, the push for financial transparency and accountability. The Synod also called for more transparency everywhere, finance councils, lay involvement, audits, even bishop evaluations.
And the abuse crisis.
That still casts a long, dark shadow. It demands constant commitment to victims, prevention, accountability. Electors will absolutely look at the Papabili's track records on this. And generally, there's likely a strong desire for a pope seen as competent in governance, in administration, someone who can manage the ship effectively.
We also can't ignore the wider world. How much does the global situation factor in?
A huge amount. The church is a global player, deeply affected by geopolitics, the war in Ukraine, tricky relations with China, the Holy Land conflict, rising nationalism, global poverty, migration, climate change. All these hit different parts of the church differently, shaping cardinals' priorities.
And the Holy See's own diplomatic standing.
It's in flux with major power, so the electors are doing some geopolitical thinking. Who has the diplomatic skill, the moral voice to navigate this complex world stage? This might boost candidates with relevant experience, Perelin, obviously, but also Gujarati, Pizzaballa, Ambongo, Chow, maybe Zuppi with his recent peace work.
Okay, so the cardinals are inside the Sistine Chapel, doors locked. What dynamics can we expect inside as they start deliberating and voting?
Well, first, remember how crucial those pre-conclave talks, the general congregations, and the pratish were? They set the stage, the information shared, the priorities identified, the candidate assessments, the consensus-building attempts, that all carries into the chapel. The high number of speakers in the GCs this time really suggests deep discussions happened. Once inside, even without formal debate during voting, those relationships and understandings heavily influence things. The Pratish especially allowed for candid talk and maybe forming initial alliances.
So inside, how do those things translate into votes? Will we see clear groups form? Are there kingmakers?
Alignments will probably form along geographical lines, theological lines, maybe around specific issues. Rigid, unbreakable blocks. Maybe less likely this time, given the diversity. But fluid groups with shared interests, definitely. Kingmakers, yeah, those influential cardinals who can steer votes because of their experience, respect, or leadership roles. Hard to name names beforehand, but they're often guys who've held big jobs, known for wisdom, or who are key voices pre-conclave. The whole game inside is finding someone who can get to 90 votes, balancing all these factors.
What about negative dynamics? Could groups unite just to stop someone? Or a minority use their nutters to block?
Oh, absolutely. Negative consensus, where different groups unite mainly to prevent candidate X from winning, even if they don't agree on who should win, is definitely possible. Francis hinted it happened in 2005, and with that two-thirds rule, strategic blocking is powerful. Get 45 votes together, and you can veto anyone unacceptable.
And the lack of familiarity could make that worse.
It could amplify it. Initial voting might be scattered as people gather info, see who has real support. You might get information cascades where later voters follow earlier trends. Persuasive whispers in the Pratish could fuel blocking strategies. If a frontrunner faces strong opposition, different groups might unite to stop them, which could drag things out and favor a compromise candidate.
Okay, crunch time.
Yeah.
After all this analysis, what's your best guess? Who are the most plausible candidates right now?
All right, based on the electorate, the issues, history, the dynamics, five names seem most plausible at this point. Cardinal Pietro Parolin, Cardinal Luis Antonio Taglo, Cardinal Peter Erdu, Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, and Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa. They kind of represent those main poles: continuity, correction, moderate institutional, and include that strong potential compromise figure.
And if you had to put rough odds on them, understanding it's purely speculative.
Super speculative, but maybe. Perelin, 20-30% position experience. Tegel, 15-25% continuity Global South. Erdu, also 15-25% correction. Zuppi, 10-20% continuity. Pizzaballa, 10-20% compromise potential. The fact these ranges overlap so much tells you there's no clear front runner, and it could be quite contested.
What about those dark horses? Could one of them actually break through?
Absolutely. Strong dark horses like Ambongo, Prevost, Gujarati, Chow, Tolentino de Mendoza, they could definitely gain traction. Compromise candidates often emerge when the main contenders stall and polarize people. Pizzaballa fits that profile, but you could also see maybe an older, respected cardinal, not currently top tier, emerge as a unifier if there's deadlock.
And how long do you think this will take? The last two were pretty quick.
They were, but factors this time point to maybe longer. Bigger, more diverse group, less familiarity, no dominant frontrunner, ideological divides. Then again, the desire for unity could push for speed. Best guess. Maybe 3 to 5 days, that's roughly 6 to 12 ballots. Shorter than that would suggest strong pre-conclave agreement. Longer suggests deep deadlock.
So pulling it all together, what are the most likely ways this could actually play out inside the Sistine Chapel? Can we sketch out a few scenarios?
Okay, three plausible scenarios. Scenario one, a swift election for continuity. Likelihood. Moderate. This happens if pre-conclave talks really solidified support around a Francis vision candidate like Tegel or Zuppi, and the Francis appointees vote cohesively. We'd see a big chunk of votes for one of them early, quick momentum, not enough opposition to block, election in maybe 2-3 days, 4 to 6 ballots. Outcome, Tegel or Zuppi wins, signaling stay the course.
Okay, scenario two.
Scenario two, a protracted search leading to compromise. Likelihood, moderate high. This feels quite possible. Initial votes are scattered. The main continuity and correction candidates can't break through. Blocking minorities are effective. Worry about deadlock grows. Conclave goes 4-6 days, maybe more, 8-15+ ballots. Focus shifts to moderates, unifiers, Perelin, Pizzaballa, Prevost, Gujarati, maybe Ambongo. Outcome. A compromise figure wins, signaling consolidation and a more measured approach to Francis's legacy.
And the third possibility.
Scenario three. A decisive shift towards correction. Likelihood. Moderate lows right now. This needs a really cohesive, strategic, conservative block, maybe behind Erdu or someone similar. Needs Francis appointees to fail to unite. Needs concerns about Francis's legacy to outweigh his appointment numbers. We might see a conservative candidate get strong early support, 40+ votes, gradually build more from moderates wanting order. Progressives fail to block. Election in maybe 3 to 4 days, 6 to 9 ballots. Outcome. Erdu or another consensus conservative wins, signaling a shift back towards tradition, discipline.
Wow. This has been an incredibly deep and really insightful look into what's coming. It's so clear just how many complex factors are swirling around as these cardinals prepare to make this choice.
It really is. You've got the large, diverse group of electors, that core tension between continuity and correction, and the very real chance, maybe even likelihood, of a compromise emerging. And all points to a fascinating and ultimately, yeah, unpredictable process. Our analysis points towards compromise being probable, but, you know, the Holy Spirit, human decisions.
Yeah.
That's what will ultimately guide them.
So, as the world watches, as those 134 cardinals get ready for the silence of the Sistine Chapel, we'll leave you, our listener, with this thought. Of all the complex issues, all of the dynamics we've talked about today, what single factor do you think will be the most decisive one for those cardinals as they take on this huge, historic responsibility? Definitely something to think about as this crucial moment unfolds.